Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey last week announced that the social media platform will ban all political ads. Dorsey said that he's concerned political ads will impact the, quote, democratic infrastructure, end quote, and that the reach of a message, quote, should be earned, not bought. Brian Fung is a technology reporter for CNN. He's been covering the news. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Twitter's not allowing any political ads on the site. How is it even defining what a political ad is?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and I think it really gets to the heart of some of the issues that tech companies face these days. Twitter is saying that it's not going to take ads from political candidates or from issue campaigns, and I think that's where the company is going to face a lot of scrutiny as it tries to decide what is and isn't a political ad.
Yeah, so much. You know, if we even take the meddling, you know, from foreign actors into account, a lot of it's not about ads that are paid for by some, you know, people for a group or a candidate. It's just stuff out there, misinformation.
Yeah, and I think, when it comes to things like ads for climate change activism or immigration or gun control, I think a lot of experts have pointed out how, in some ways, Twitter's policy could make things a lot more complicated for political activists on Facebook. And I think that's something that the company is going to have to really sort through, and it's going to probably take a lot of criticism for as it tries to implement the details of this new policy.
The Twitter CEO or CFO, Ned Segal, last week said that the company made less than $3 million from political ads in the 2018 cycle. It was a midterms, not a big year. But what do we know about how much revenue political ads generate on social media?
Yeah, so political ads for Twitter didn't seem to be that big of a business. As you mentioned, $3 million in the 2018 cycle. I think, that really shows how, for Twitter, this was not a difficult financial decision, whereas for a company like Facebook, CEO Mark Zuckerberg has said that next year it expects that political ads will account for 0.5% of the company's revenue, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, just thinking about how much Facebook makes in terms of revenue on any given year, mm-hmm. 0.5% of the company's revenues last year would have been more than $274 million. So, the idea that there's no money at stake here at all is a little bit disingenuous when it comes to a company like Facebook, which is just so much bigger than Twitter and smaller firms.
Right, and to that point, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg has reiterated that they will continue to put political advertising on, but there's been sort of this campaign on the part of Democratic presidential hopeful Senator Warren from Massachusetts, that she keeps posting things that are out and out lies to make the point that you have to have some kind of control.
Yeah, that's really came up a few weeks ago when Senator Warren took out a fake ad on Facebook, falsely claiming that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg had endorsed President Trump for re-election. That was patently not true, and in fact, the senator noted that in the ad itself. Mm-hmm. But the whole point was to draw attention to Facebook's policy, and in fact, we're gonna just today. There's going to be a series of meetings involving Facebook's fact checkers at its headquarters in Menlo Park in California, sort of to discuss some of these issues. And one of the fact-checking partners that Facebook employs is going to make a proposal about how political ads could be fact-checked. We'll see where that goes, but I think Facebook is really struggling to deal with this this issue, particularly because of some of the complicated concerns around definitions that we sort of discussed a little bit earlier.
And they are Zuckerberg saying that they need to be careful about adopting more and more rules surrounding political speech. He's concerned, he said repeatedly, about the free speech issue.
That's right. And I think, you know, when Facebook has, when you think about how Facebook has positioned itself on this issue, and in light of Mark Zuckerberg's recent speech at Georgetown University, he's really casting Facebook in sort of grand historical terms as at the center of kind of an epic struggle of ideas about freedom of expression versus sort of the forces of censorship. And you know, I think reasonable people can disagree about whether or not that framing is accurate, but it's clear that, you know, Zuckerberg sees himself kind of in the middle of this this kind of grand struggle of ideas.
Has Facebook had problems in other countries on this score?
Well, certainly, you know, Facebook disinformation and misinformation has, you know, been linked to big problems in places like Myanmar, and you know, there's been a lot of concern about how Facebook, you know, handles elections not just in the United States but around the world, and the question for Facebook is, you know, what types of policies are appropriate for each country and for the company as a whole as it tries to combat some of these negative effects.
Is there a role for government in all of this?
Well, I think we're currently seeing Congress grappling with what to do about content moderation. In fact, you have a number of lawmakers who've proposed updating the law that gives Facebook and other tech companies immunity for the content that largely, for most of the content that appears on their platforms. This law, known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, has been, you know, pretty vital in terms of giving small startups and new websites the ability to grow and to thrive free from the threat of private litigation over what appears on their platforms. And I think it's a big question going forward whether that policy will remain in place as we debate some of these political challenges.
Twitter decision I guess it depends on where you're coming from. Those on the right think that it's intended to punish right-wing media and not liberals. How does Twitter defend itself against that?
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, critics of Twitter have said the decision by Twitter to stop you know, running political ads altogether, it kind of lets it off the hook a little bit in that the company gets to avoid having to make difficult decisions about, you know, what type of content, you know, hate speech and whatnot qualifies as under the ban. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be as rigorous in taking down, you know, that type of content. I think it sort of remains to be seen whether or not that's the case. You know, Twitter isn't rolling out this policy until sometime later this month, and there will be probably an opportunity for you know, the public to weigh in both before and after.
How has Google responded to all of this?
Well, Google has mainly tried to stay out of the limelight here, but I think in recent weeks there's been kind of a push by some lawmakers to drive more attention to Google. Obviously, Google's big platform of concern here is YouTube and the comments sections surrounding YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. But Google has also sort of been taken to task over the way that it handles children's content. You know, recently the Federal Trade Commission settled with YouTube over the way that it was collecting children's information without parental consent on a lot of videos. And so the company has had to make a lot of changes, including, you know, forcing creators of children's videos to say whether or not their content is directed at children.
Google requires that someone who wants to buy a political ad must verify their eligibility to do so in the U.S. Why not that? Why not just where does that work and where does it not work?
Sure. I think, you know, Facebook has similar policies, and they're working on, you know, updating the transparency requirements and giving users more information about who is paying for a particular ad and where, you know, where the money for that ad is coming from. I do think, though, that, you know, in talking to a lot of Democratic experts lately, there's a growing concern about whether or not the ad transparency tools that these companies provide are actually adequate in helping researchers suss out potential examples of disinformation or malfeasance. You know, the companies, if you look at the ad tools they provide, you know, they allow you to make individual searches for particular, you know, words, keywords, or terms, and it'll show you, you know, every single ad that has sort of run based on those keywords. But it makes it very difficult to do much more than that, you know, sort of ad hoc, random analysis of what's on the platform. So I think that's probably an area where a lot of experts will try to push Facebook and Google to improve.
And I go back to the point I made at the very beginning, is none of this necessarily goes to the toxicity online now. Anybody could post anything they want. It's a free country. It's free speech, right? Is that what you're saying? Is you don't know who's being paid to do that and who's not?
That's part of the concern, and then another concern that you know, particularly has been raised by civil rights leaders is, you know, by allowing politicians to say whatever they like on campaign ads and not have that content be fact-checked, it really opens the door to potential voter suppression. And even if so companies like Facebook have existing policies on the books that ban voter suppression, and in congressional testimony, Mark Zuckerberg said, you know, if a politician were to try to mislead voters about where and when to vote, that type of ad would be taken down. But, you know, civil rights leaders say it's actually, you know, the issue of voter suppression is much more complicated than that and can include not just specific misleading content about place and time for polling, but also, you know, racially charged messages in ads that can serve to deter people from going to the ballot box. So it's much more nuanced and complicated. And last night at a dinner with civil rights leaders, Mark Zuckerberg heard a lot about that from civil rights groups.
And how did he respond?
Well, details of that meeting are still trickling out. The attendees aren't offering specifics about what commitments the company may have made, but you know, Mark Zuckerberg was there, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg was there, as was Nick Clegg, the head of global affairs and communications. And in general, you know, the attendees said it was a very substantive discussion, and that Mark and Sheryl were very deeply engaged. So I think a lot of them came away feeling encouraged about having been listened to.
Brian Fung, thanks for your time today. I always appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Brian Fung, technology reporter for CNN. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ooh. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Robots and artificial intelligence won't take your job, but they might change it. That's according to a new report from MIT and the IBM Watson AI Lab, which found that the so-called automation revolution probably won't mean physical robots replacing human workers. Martin Fleming is the vice president and chief economist at IBM and lead author of the report. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. I'm pleased to be with you.
How did you study this?
Well, we have access through our colleagues at Burning Glass Technologies to 170 million job posts. So those are the text job posts that we all see on the web. And we use our capabilities through a natural language processing set of tools on the IBM cloud to translate the unstructured text data into structured data that allows us to unearth the trends that we see across the U.S. labor market.
And the research already, you know, a lot of what we hear and what we've been prepared to face is robots taking over our jobs. That's not exactly what it's about. It's more about the artificial intelligence piece, and it's not about taking the jobs, right?
Yeah. So the first lesson that we've all learned is that robotics technology is very different from artificial intelligence technology. It's an old technology versus a new technology. And certainly anybody in the Midwestern region of the U.S. would be very concerned about the replacement that robots have made for humans. And that's understandable. That's the intention in the automotive industry, the electronics products manufacturing industries, and others. Robots are replacing people. That's not what artificial intelligence is about. It's about creating tools and capabilities to help workers become more productive. I would never assert that there will be no jobs lost as a result of the deployment of artificial intelligence tools, but it's much more about productivity in improvement than it is displacement of workers.
I read an example, like, say you have somebody who's a salesperson and they do pricing, and you know, the AI could do more of the rote kind of pricing, and the human could do the more complicated, nuanced kind of pricing things that would give them more time to do that. But I thought, well, all right, but that's something you kind of work up to, isn't it? And you start with the more prosaic and work to the more complicated. That piece is going to be missing in the kind of the scheme of training, isn't it?
Well, it is, but the folks who work in finance operations and are concerned with pricing and setting pricing across all of the various firms and industries are really quite skilled folks. And they are very, very able to take on more challenging, complex tasks, and actually oftentimes find it more interesting and more enjoyable work than the more routine pricing of transactions that oftentimes are occurring currently.
And another thing about AI versus our images of the robots is that AI's, it's already happening all over the place. We're just not seeing it.
Well, that's true. We're not seeing it. I wouldn't go quite so far to say it's already happening. We see a very significant number of artificial intelligence solutions being deployed in the technology industry. IBM and our peer firms are certainly very active in this space. We also see it in the financial services space with a great deal of skill developed already in solutions being deployed. Other industries are coming along. This is a rather dramatic change, not just because of the technology, but also because of it's transforming how work is being done, and it requires a lot of change and change management on the part of senior leaders as well as workers. So we're still in the early days here.
What kinds of jobs, is there a way to generalize about the sorts of jobs that will be affected by the growing use of AI?
Sure. So certainly there are more routine tasks And you cited one great example already of relatively routine pricing applications. There are others. But it really, the deployment of the technology really places a real premium and increases value on workers' ability to engage with other workers, to be able to communicate effectively, to be able to deploy people skills, if you will, teaming, communication. All of those kinds of capabilities are the skills that are being much more highly valued and we're already seeing being rewarded in the marketplace.
And does that mean that it's going to develop more jobs like that with soft skills,
absolutely.
People skills? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Number one is as productivity continues to grow as a result of the tools and the deployment, more jobs are created and more jobs are created at higher wages. So there's as productivity improves, there's an increase in employment and an increase in wages. And number two, it changes the way we work and the nature of work. So you're right. There is a very dramatic change in how we work and the tasks that we perform in the pipeline here coming along.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the impact on jobs when it comes to artificial intelligence. My guest is Martin Fleming. He's vice president and chief economist at IBM. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You were looking for tasks that are suitable for machine learning. I guess there's a shorthand for that, SML. What kinds of occupations are more suitable for machine learning?
So this is an important distinction you've hit upon. It's not occupations as much as it is tasks
okay.
that make up occupations. So we all are engaged in an occupation, whether one is an economist or a radio broadcaster. We perform a collection of tasks. Some of those tasks are suitable for machine learning. Others are not. What our research shows is that there are a small number of occupations where there are a large number of tasks that are suitable for machine learning. There are a much larger number of occupations where a small number of tasks are suitable for machine learning. So that's why we say all jobs will change, because to some degree, machine learning will impact the tasks that all workers perform to some degree. And that's the distinction that we think is helpful for workers to understand.
You said in an article I read, I think it's in Tech Republic, that the transformation of the workforce by way of AI is an opportunity for the government and employers to improve training and education programs and catch up to other reskilling efforts in other countries. What are they doing in other countries? What is there a model out there?
Well, I think the model that is quite widely cited is the German model, which has a long history of apprenticeship and training that has actually been very, very successful. In the U.S., we don't have certainly quite the same heritage, but it's certainly a model to be looked at. And some of the Scandinavian countries have made a larger financial investment in training. The U.S. Investment in training is actually quite limited relative to many, many other nations.
What does the training look like? What do we mean by that?
Well, it means helping workers learn new skills, new capabilities to be able to shift their focus from the tasks that they've previously been performing to those tasks which cannot be automated and now are going to create more value for those workers. One of the findings of our research is for those tasks that cannot be automated, we've seen wage rates and compensation increase quite significantly over the past few years. So that's where the opportunity for improvement in incomes and standards of living is going to come from, by focusing on those tasks where the workers take on much greater value.
Let's see. David in Columbus, you're on the air with Martin Fleming, chief economist at IBM. Hi, David.
Hi. I work in healthcare, and I would say it's naive to say the jobs aren't eliminated. In the last 4 or 5 years, I've watched claim adjusting units within health insurance companies eliminate, I can think of probably 12 or 14 floors in one building, and replaced all of those employees with maybe one for every 15 or 18, a senior adjuster. I've watched my attorneys do away with 4 or 5 paralegals per attorney, and you know the firm then adds maybe 2 attorneys. So while the jobs are higher in income that are replaced, vast swaths of jobs are going away. And I think it's naive to say that all of those people are going to be retrained into better, higher jobs.
Hmm. Martin Fleming? Comment. Yeah, well, thanks a lot, David. Martin Fleming?
So I agree. It is certainly naive to say that there will be no jobs eliminated. I agree with David's point completely. We certainly see a tremendous transformation occurring across the U.S. labor market and other labor markets. Let me just hit on 2 of the illustrations that he cites. In the case of attorneys, it's certainly true that there's been a great deal of automation that has occurred that have allowed a lot of the discovery and document management that paralegals have done to be automated. But what has happened, it has reduced the expense of taking on much larger cases and much larger claims. And as a result, the total number of attorneys has actually increased over time. So you're right. There's a shifting of skill and a shifting of focus. And he's also right, moving from a paralegal to an attorney. In the healthcare space, the ability to diagnose clinical cases more productively, more effectively has increased, while many of the administrative tasks in the claims area are being automated. But the final point that David makes is really the most important one. It's the challenge that workers face in continuing to train, retrain, upgrade their skills, engage in continuous learning. It's not easy. It oftentimes requires a sacrifice of personal time and family time. But the reality is we have to all continue to grow our skills day after day, week after week, month after month in the world that we're in and in the world we're moving to.
There was in the same article in Tech Republic, there was reference to another researcher, Carl Benedict Frey. He made an initial prediction about the number of jobs being at high risk for automation and is quoted in your MIT IBM research. And he said that one of the things that said in here that his latest thinking is that the true concern is not about automation in general, but that the revolution won't go far enough. It'll be incomplete. They'll stop short. What do you make of that?
I think he's absolutely right. If we as a global economy deploy only so-so technology, if it's not fully effective, the workers won't benefit from the productivity gains that are possible and therefore the income gains that are possible, and businesses won't benefit from those productivity gains. What's necessary is to continue to deploy the technology to get the benefits that we're all going to see over the course, hopefully we'll see over the course of years and the decades ahead. And we can compare it to other technologies in the past where we've seen successful transformation. But it's an important point.
What would you compare it to that people might recognize?
Well, sure. So there are a number of historic analogies. One is, of course, going back 100 and 120 years, the advent of the power loom was at the leading edge of technology, the ability to have more than one suit of clothes for the apparel and clothing industry was a huge technological advance. which over the course of the 19th century increased workers' wages considerably. The advent of electric power in the early 20th century fundamentally transformed manufacturing, allowing manufacturers to move their facilities away from bodies of water, rivers and other canals, to a much flatter deployment in suburban locations, which allowed for enormous increases in productivity and gains in workers' wages and incomes in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So these are very fundamental technological transformations that we've seen. We're now, I would assert, in the fifth such iteration. Others would call it the fourth, but we've seen these historic epics in the past.
And as far as the power looms went, the automated looms, that meant that workers were now responsible for operating the power looms, which is required more skills than the loom itself, than running the looms themselves.
That is true. But at the same time, it reduced the prices and the cost of clothing by 98% over 100 years. So the demand for clothing exploded.
Gotcha.
And therefore, the expansion of the industry was enormous, and therefore workers actually had to be imported. We needed to bring workers in to fill all the jobs, and wages just really dramatically increased.
Martin Fleming, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure. Pleased to be with you.
Martin Fleming, Vice President and Chief Economist at IBM. We've been talking about what the AI revolution means to jobs. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley of Android Central. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple AirPods are the best-selling headphones in the world, but is the new version worth it? Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central, recently wrote about the new AirPods. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Russell joins us now. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I was a little stressed out reading your article about this because I just kept worrying they were going to fall out of your ears and I wondered how you were testing it and how that worked.
This is a very real concern because the original version of the AirPods not only did fall out of my ears, but I lost them a week after I bought them. And I have the case for those AirPods, but never actually found the little earbuds after they fell out of my ears. So it was definitely something I was concerned about with this set. But in order to test them, I wanted to make sure that I could go for a run with them. So I found a 5K circuit around my neighborhood and went for a run with them in my ears just to see what would happen.
Now, at first, they stayed in okay. What happened?
Yeah, so the first mile and a half, they were fine. They're very secure. These aren't like the original AirPods. They actually have rubber tips that fit in your ear very much like traditional earbuds and create that kind of feel. But it's still kind of a rubbery material that holds in there. And after a while, there's just, there's an amount of movement that comes from jogging. And doing that, for an extended period of time will eventually cause those things to dislodge. And that was what happened. They started to slide. I could feel them start to slide out of my ears. I could hear, more noise coming in my ears from the active noise cancellation starting to fail. And it became really clear that the headphones were not sticking around by a little after the second mile that I had run. And so I started, kind of reaching up and pushing them back in my ears to make sure that they stayed. They never actually fell out of my ears, but they definitely became, loose to a point where I was worried about them three different times during the run.
So what was the verdict?
I think that these are probably fine for a lot of people to take to the gym. I think these are probably not super great for people who do distance running. And that entire setup is we make really good sport headphones for a reason. People in the audio industry, they tend to make headphones that are secure, to make sure that it's comfortable for people who are doing that kind of running. They don't want to have to worry about whether their headphones are going to fall out. But I think for most people, being able to just kind of walk around and occasionally, run from one place to another, and I doubt that there's ever going to be a concern for that kind of user, even casually at the gym, that their headphones are going to fall out.
How are they different, though, than previous versions?
So the biggest difference is the original version is very much like the headphones that come in the box for your iPhone, where it's got this kind of plastic little, half circle that you just kind of hang on to your ear, and it's enough to stay in there for most things. But this upgraded design actually has a piece that sticks out a little further than that, and it has these kind of rubbery tips that fit into your ear and actually create a seal for active noise cancellation to work. There's actually a test on the phone when you have put them in that actually performs a vibration test to confirm that the headphones are seated in your ears correctly, which is great for people who have trouble getting earbuds that are the right fit. My mom, for example, frequently has earbuds that she will put in that will be painful if they are in for too long because they're just the wrong size. And this fitness test actually helps with that, which I thought was deeply instructive and not something I've seen any other headphone company do.
Do they have different sizes?
They have three different size tips that come in the box. There's kind of a medium size tip that's included that are attached to the AirPods. And then there's a smaller version and a larger version that you can attach depending on what your needs are.
Did the price increase?
The price increased considerably. The original AirPods were $150, which were considered a little on the high end for what you were getting. The audio quality wasn't super great, and they were a convenient tech gadget, but they were kind of kind of expensive for what you were buying, and not generally speaking worth it, in my opinion. These AirPods Pro are $250.
Whoa!
Which is more than most people will ever spend on headphones. And with good reasons. The headphones are that you can get a lot of audio quality from a $250 set of headphones that are much better audio quality than you would get for these. The reason that someone would buy these is for the convenience of them. As soon as you open the box, they immediately pair to your phone. They stay connected. They work in a way that is unlike any other set of Bluetooth headphones. And they have a really incredible microphone on them that just sounds phenomenal. It filters out so much noise from the world around you, so that I was actually on a skating rink with a DJ playing with very loud speakers next to me. And the person that I was talking to asked me if I was sitting in my car because they could not hear any of the things that were happening around me, which astounded me because of how much noise there was around me.
Wait, you were talking to somebody on your phone and using the earbuds in a skating rink?
I was at an outdoor skating rink.
It sounds unsafe for Russell. But
it definitely was unsafe. It was a bad decision. But it worked, and I learned something from it. So I'm going to go ahead and take it.
Okay. All right. Huawei's troubles with the U.S. might be coming to an end with a new trade deal. What's going on with that?
Hopefully. So we've been hearing a lot about the U.S. and China, working on a trade deal that's supposed to come together soon. And there's obviously been a lot of political news around that. But we got a little more information about how that might impact Huawei specifically. There's actually supposed to be a total of 206 license applications that U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is going to, be able to give to U.S. companies in order to allow them to do business with Huawei directly. And so those license applications, if even half of them are approved, would include companies like Google being able to license its software to Huawei so that those phones can continue to use the Android application stack and be able to run as a normal Android phone, which is something that their phones can't currently do. And so it's possible that as a part of this trade deal, that Huawei could actually start being sold in the U.S. for the first time ever instead of being something that needed to be imported.
I thought they were worried about Huawei's relationship with the Chinese government and whether or not they may be using, access, trying to get access to American data through Huawei.
That is absolutely what we were told 2 months ago. Okay. You are definitely correct. You did not mishear that.
And so, we're not worried about that anymore.
Was reported. that seems to not be something our current Commerce Secretary, who was our Commerce Secretary when that statement was made, is currently concerned with.
Huh. And by the way, for people who don't know, Huawei, it's spelled H-U-A-W-E-I. It took me a while to remember how to pronounce it. But thanks to you. It's big. This is a really big company.
Outside of the United States, this is the largest smartphone company on the planet. They are massive in the UK. They are just phenomenally large in India and China, in North and South Korea. You will see even in North Korea, there are versions of Huawei phones that are available to military operatives. Like they are, it is a massive brand that has a huge global audience that the United States basically doesn't know about. And some of that is because the company has a really abominable track record of creating phones using technologies that it does not have patents for.
Mm-hmm.
So the phones legally cannot be sold in the U.S. because they collide with patents that Apple and Motorola and Samsung and several other companies have. But there are places in China that do not follow those regulations, so they are permitted to be sold. So it's still not 100% clear exactly what Huawei's footprint in the United States would look like, even if all of these license requests were to go through. But it is certainly a path forward for the company that did not exist 2 months ago.
And its potential competitors in the U.S., what do they think?
If you know, the United States ends up becoming okay with these phones being sold and there ends up not being any active patent disputes with the versions of the phones that get sold, there's plenty of reasons for United States manufacturers to be concerned, because Huawei frequently is able to undercut big names like Apple and Samsung on price without sacrificing any of the features. And that is something that has been noticed around the world, is one of the reasons why it's so popular.
Have you used Huawei phones?
I've used Huawei phones on several occasions.
And what do you think?
I think the hardware is often very nice. They have a unique design that ends up being, you know, kind of very flashy, especially in the back. I never say something about how I like pretty colors.
Right.
Huawei phones often take pretty colors on phones and then add really dynamic textures that make it seem like the back is actually like animated.
Mm-hmm.
But the hardware itself is often very good. They use a processor that we don't use here in the U.S. Processor chipset type called Kirin. That is often a little faster than some of the stuff that we see from Qualcomm. But again, that runs into some really interesting patent discussions that are going to have to happen in order for these phones to be sold here.
Will this enable Huawei to get involved in all the 5G development?
Yeah, it's definitely possible. Huawei has been a huge push into 5G when it comes to other parts of the world, and Nokia and Ericsson have been competing with Huawei in several other countries. And a lot of that stuff is going to come here to the U.S. Now, you know, we still have an intelligence infrastructure that is very much opposed to having Huawei hardware involved in our United States network infrastructure. So
okay.
It's entirely possible that conversation would be separate.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Casely is a company that lets you pick a new phone case every month. Why?
Right. This is a really fascinating. This is the first question that I had. That is the exact question that I had. There, you know, I have run into people who get very excited about a phone, and when they get very excited about a phone, they buy a lot of different cases. You know, I have never done this. I might buy, in the lifetime that I have a phone, let's say a 2-year span that I have a phone, I might have two different cases for the phone. I have the phone, that, you know, case that goes on my bike, and the case that I have when I'm out, just kind of keeping it safe. But I have seen people, especially when they go to sell a phone on maybe eBay or Craigslist or something like that, where they sell a phone, but then they sell the phone in like 30 cases because they've just bought so many different colorful cases where it's Tuesday, I feel like having a blue case. Casely is a service for those people in that every single month for this monthly rate, you can get a unique looking case in order to you know, just kind of look a little different and you know, kind of spark things up a little bit. You know, if you decide that you want something that has sunflowers all over the back of it 1 month, that's, you know, the decision you can make, and they'll just ship it to you like any other case. And I just thought that was really fascinating. And I still don't fully know how many people would jump at something like this, but it seemed really interesting.
I don't even know what my phone looks like. The case has been on it for so long. I don't even know what color it is. So it's a subscription service. What's about the durability and the quality of these cases? If they sound kind of throwaway, is that the intention, or is it to be switching up?
No, the idea is to switch back and forth depending on your mood. It's definitely not that these cases are falling apart in a month. These are solid, hard cases. In many you know, situations, they have, you know, kind of these hard wrap designs. But you know, several of the different designs we have are you know, that we had to evaluate are unique. It's difficult to find versions that look anything quite like this when you are out and about. One had, you know, just kind of an intricate lunar phase going across the back that I did not discover until much later, actually glow in the dark, each one of the different lunar phases, which was just kind of a clever thing to have, but also probably indicative that I am secretly a 12-year-old. So it was, you know, just a lot of different designs where if you decided that you wanted this, you know, and you felt like it was worth that kind of monthly subscription, that this was an option that was available.
So what's Apple think about this?
I mean, Apple doesn't really have a particularly, I guess the nice way to say is that they don't really get a vote. You know, if the case meets the standards for an iPhone, then they can still be sold. And Casely does, in fact, have iPhone cases on their website. So if you have a, you know, you have an iPhone or you have a Samsung Galaxy, then you can, you know, choose these cases and participate in this monthly subscription.
Are these cases just for looks, or are they also good at protecting the phone? You know, my issues.
These are hard cases that will handle your average impact probably once or twice, which is what you get from most cases that you spend $20 on. You know, so that's probably fair. I don't know that this is going to protect you from any massive drops from any heights, or if you accidentally run the, you know, phone over or anything like that. Mm-hmm. This case is not going to protect from any kind of extreme damage.
And they're $20 a piece?
If you want to buy them individually, they're $25. If you want to take part in the subscription, you can start the subscription at $10 a month.
Wow. Okay. So for all the stylers out there you go.
That's
Motorola
right.
is resurrecting the Razr phone with a foldable screen, another foldable screen. Pros, cons?
Do you remember the Razr phone?
Yeah.
Lots of people remember the Razr phone. It was probably like the first phone that I can remember, aside from the Motorola StarTech, that it was like a brand that people recognized and got excited by.
Mm-hmm.
This phone looks very, very similar from the images that we've seen so far to that original Razr design, only when you flip the top part of the phone up, everything that you see on the inside is the screen.
Oh.
There is no keyboard. There is, you know, nothing like that. It's all display when you flip this phone out. So it looks very much like the original Motorola Razr on the outside, but then on the inside you get this unique kind of design. Which is very clever, but also, you know, it's another folding screen, which means it's going to have a lot of the same concerns
okay.
that the current folding screens have. Samsung, you know, while they did this recall, I mean, not really a recall, they pulled back their phones and delayed the launch of the phone because they ran into some design issues. And even now, we have reports of people who have the Galaxy Fold where they still are just not particularly durable phones. There's very little to suggest that Motorola has done anything spectacularly different to make this phone more durable.
Okay.
Aside from, of course, you know, the display is entirely on the inside for this phone. So you know, it is likely to be able to handle the occasional drop. And Motorola is the company behind the shatterproof displays of several years ago, where you could kind of drop the phone from a great distance and not worry about the screen shattering because the screen was made of plastic. So it could be a very interesting phone. We're going to learn more about it over the next couple of weeks, for sure. But it's definitely, you know, it's a really curious nostalgia hit because people are going to see this and remember when they had a Razr phone.
Right. Yeah. And what about the price tag? Is it going to be memorable in that way as well?
It's definitely going to be memorable in that way, but probably not positive in its memory. You know, it's worth pointing out that the Samsung Galaxy Fold is $1,980. The Motorola Razr will almost assuredly be less than that because it only has the one display instead of two great big ones, and folds in kind of a very traditional way. So I would be surprised if this phone was less than $1,500.
Mm.
But that, you know, it probably isn't going to be terribly more than that either. But we'll know for sure once the official announcement.
How big is the screen once it's opened up?
When it opens up, it looks like it's and it looks like it's about 8 or 9 inches across, but it's kind of a narrow, tall screen. So all of the pictures that we've seen, it looks like someone is using it with two hands. And the more you look at it, the more it feels like it kind of has to be used with two hands, because it's this kind of very tall screen. So getting to the stuff that's at the top of the phone might be a little unusual.
Okay. Well, I will look forward to your reviews of that. In the meantime, Russell Halley, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Halley, contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us every week on Tech Tuesday. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.